PPI.org. And good evening. Thank you for joining Disability and Progress, where we give you insights into ideas about and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam. I'm the host of the show. Charlene Dahl is my research woman, but she is out tonight. Feel better, Charlene. Tonight in the studio, well, before I start, if you want to be on my email list, you may email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. That's disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. Tonight we are in the studio with an author, Bruce Aereo. Good evening, Bruce.
Good evening, Sam.
Thank you so much for coming in. It's a beautiful night.
Yeah, it's lovely outside.
Bruce is an author. His latest book is Everyone is a Star. And what a great name. So, Bruce, you are very good. I think you are somebody who's proven, you know, you have a disability and you are pretty successful. Can you talk about a little bit about the disability that came along later in life?
Well, I had a car accident, Sam, at age 24. And I had some experience of confused thinking and some nausea and some confused thinking, and but I did not seek out medical help because I was afraid of being labeled as mentally ill. And so I went 9 months before I saw treatment, but it became impossible to go on without getting some kind of help. And so I went into a psych ward, and he made a snap diagnosis and called me schizophrenic. And because he saw I was delusional, I had had a break, a psychotic break from reality. Mm-hmm. And he saw that, and then he diagnosed it as schizophrenia. I did not mention the car accident. So I've been treated for schizophrenia since that time. But somewhere along the line, maybe 10 years later, people started coming up to me and saying, now that you're getting better, can't you look back and tell that it was a car accident at the exact time when you changed? And I said, well, it seemed to me that that next morning I woke up after the car accident, I had some classic traumatic brain injury symptoms. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize it. I was a wild child, and I did not want to be on any psych ward. Mm. And so I refused to get medical help, although my friends tried to convince me of it. They kind of watched me decompensate, and finally my parents came, and they said, this has got to stop. You have to go into the hospital, to which I agreed with. And so I was on a psych ward, and then I went back to my old ways immediately after getting off the psych ward and tried to put the whole experience behind me. Uh-huh. And it didn't work. I was on the psych ward a second time and had a very comforting psychiatrist that was kind of the opposite of the first psychiatrist. His name was Dr. Headland. And he got me to trust him. And I got into law school and was trying to put the whole mental illness thing behind me. I thought, you know, I could do that, but I couldn't. And I lost my concentration, lost my focus, and ended up homeless. And then I broke the law and got onto a psych ward again. And this time they offered me a choice, either go into the mental health system or go to jail. And I said, I want the mental health system. And so they said, I think you made a good choice. The judge said that. And so I went into a psych ward, a mental health halfway house, group home. And I had a very astute, very sensitive, very loving, very caring, and also very adept. She was very adept at what she did. And she got me accepting my mental illness. It didn't matter what caused it. The fact is I was having problems. And she got me started as a writer. And then the rest is just kind of followed from that. Her name was Joan Unger.
Aww.
And she's a hero in my life. I still write her at Christmas time, although she's Jewish.
But, that's all good. She'll have some holiday to remember you by then.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how you became a writer. Is there somebody who saw you write and said, hey, you should do this?
Well, that's another story. When I was on the streets homeless, this other homeless man was quite a bit older than me. He was, mm-hmm. I was in my 30s, early 30s, and he was in his 60s or 70s, mm-hmm. and he stopped me in the library and said, what are you doing with your life? Because he knew I was homeless. He, we had seen each other around soup halls and stuff like that. And he goes, what are you doing with your life? And I said, well, I was in law school. And he goes, really? And I said, yes. And he goes, well, what do you want to do with your life now? And I started to say something. And he goes, shh, quieted me down. And goes, here, write it on this piece of paper. And so he handed me a piece of paper. And I wrote, I want to be a writer. And he read it. And he goes, shh, go ahead and do it. And that's when I made the decision to be a writer. I had always considered myself a decent writer in school, mm-hmm. but it wasn't something I wanted to pursue. It was a pipe dream, something that would never happen. I was going to be a lawyer. Uh-huh. And I didn't give up that idea for some time, but that psychologist in the halfway house started me into thinking that, you know, that... that was a bigger pipe dream than being a writer. Being a writer is realistic. It's something anybody can do. All you need is a pen and a piece of paper. But it's a commitment I've had. My commitment is a page a day, mm-hmm. and I've gone with that now since 1986. And so I've been writing some time, and I've got about 6 or 7 books on Kindle, and 3 paperbacks.
Excellent. Well, I'm not sure if anybody can do it. I don't know if I'd want people to read my writing.
I know. You have to develop thick skin because you know the critics are out there. Mm. It's kind of a challenge, though. If you can get the critic to say something good about it, so much the better. But even if they don't, you have to have thick skin enough to still believe in yourself and go forward. I've had many people disparage my writing. I've had many people praise it. I've had both. And so I like the people that praise it better.
Of course.
And I go with that.
So let's talk about your latest book. It's entitled Everyone's a Star. Talk about where you got the idea for that story. Where did that come from?
Well, when I was young, we talked about the kids in the suburbs. Mm-hmm. I was a city kid, and we talked about the kids in the suburbs, and we said they all have stars in their eyes, and I thought that was a bad thing. But then the older I got, the more I realized being a star is a good thing. And, you know, they were getting something out in the suburbs that a lot of people were not accessible to a lot of people. They just weren't raised that way to think of themselves as a star. They were raised to think of themselves as like working class or, you know, knuckling under and being a Christian, going to church. And nobody was really telling them to be stars, at least not in my neighborhood or at the schools I went to. And then I came up with the idea of, why can't everybody be a star? Because it's kind of fun if you think of yourself as a star. Mm. You know, if you think of yourself highly enough to think that you're interesting enough, that you have enough, you have a hidden talent, maybe not hidden, maybe it's out in the open, but to think that you have a talent and you have a special mission in life. My dad gave me that I had a mission in life. But he did not necessarily raise me to be a star. But when he saw I took off on writing, he would throw that comment out there. Maybe you become a star, Bruce. And so I thought everybody is a star. Everyone is a star. Some people have bad luck, but they rise up from it. I had a car accident. I had bad luck. It was my own fault. But at some point, I've started thinking of myself as a star, not in a grandiose kind of Hollywood way, but just as a person that was applying the talents the best they could in their life and making themselves something beyond just every day.
I want to go back to a comment that you made when you said,
sure.
In the suburbs, when you saw people and you thought they had stars in their eyes, was that meaning like you thought that they weren't seeing reality?
I thought that at the time.
Ah.
I thought reality was a city.
Ah.
And I wasn't envious. In fact, we kind of ridiculed it, to tell you the truth. But then the older I got, I befriended some kids, got to know some people from the suburbs, and they were good people. And I began to see that their parents had given them a nice life and that they should be happy. And then I said, why can't everybody be a star? Is it all based on having a lot of money? And I said, no, not really. There's been people that have been stars that were very poor. So I thought everybody could become a star. And I thought, especially in the environment I'm in, that's very important. I work for Task Unlimited. And the people have a mental illness. And I thought, if these folks can think of themselves as stars, then that's my mission.
There are two characters, particular ones I'm thinking of in your book, Bill and Sarah. Who are these based on?
Both of them are really me.
Oh.
That's the simple answer.
Expand
Bill,
on that one.
Bill is what I might have become. He's a lawyer and becomes a judge. I don't know if I would ever meet a judge, but I had ambitions to be a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bill, and have a family. And so Bill is a lawyer, and he's kind of like compassionate, liberal, confident, and has a idea that he's kind of special. And he has an idol, mm-hmm. who is another character in the book. We might mm-hmm. get to that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But his daughter has a mental illness, and that's like me too. And she's very rebellious, which I was. You can ask my parents if I was rebellious. You can ask my friends if I was rebellious. So she's rebellious, and she's at her father's throat like I was. And she's unsatisfied, asking a lot of questions, being very hard to live with, which was I was. But in the end, she becomes a star in her own right. She steps out of her mental illness and comes across to her father as a real daughter, something that was beyond her when she was in the depths of her delusions. But she steps out of that, at least at part. I don't want to spoil the story, but...
No, don't spoil the story.
I won't spoil the story.
You have somebody that Bill admires and really puts up on a pedestal. The character Randall Smith, who's he based on? And why is he getting so much trouble?
It's the character of Bob Dylan, my boyhood idol.
Okay.
Dylan doesn't necessarily get in a lot of trouble, but he's not known for being really on the right side of the law. He has quotes where he says, if you live outside the law, you have to be honest. And, he's known as kind of a radical, kind of a free spirit, very much a free spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill in the book has this character named Randall Smith. Now, Randall Smith in the book is a blues artist that has a following, and he's black.
Mm-hmm.
So it's different. I disguise Dylan a little bit, but he's got the same populist kind of ideas, the same kind of affinity for the downcast, a champion of the little guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's Randall Smith is all of that. And I believe the idea that everybody is a star is something that Bob Dylan would agree with. I think he would.
What message would you like to deliver to the readers through your story?
Well, I just want to say that, we're all worthwhile people. We all got gifts. Some people get all the recognition in Hollywood and in politics and in sports. but everybody is a star. Everyone I've ever met along my life, I saw some good in. It took a big effort on some people's part, but I saw some good in everybody that I ever dealt with. And I just imagined that people were the same all over the world. And I've traveled and met other people from other countries. And people have something good in them. I look back at the idea that Christ called us sinners. And did he really think we were, that was the limitation we had? And I said, no. He said we committed sins. But I believe Christ even thought we were good people who committed sins. And human by nature, analysis, is good. I think God sees the good in us, and that's what he wants us to see. And people screw up. I screwed up. But I wanted to have the message that people are good and should strive to be good, and basically strive to be a star, you know, in their own life. And damn to the people that keep you down and hold you back, and don't let them. Keep thinking of yourself as a star. And I like to pride myself that I never really, I had situations where I wasn't the nicest guy, but I always saw good in people. I always wanted them to be a star in their own right. I may have challenged them. I may have, looked like I didn't even like them, but I did. You know, I liked everybody.
How do you come up with the names of your books?
The names of the books, they just come to me. I believe in the muse, Sam. I believe in the muse, and my writing comes from some unknown part of me that the muse has given me, and I never question it. I just have a feel for what the muse wants me to say, and I've been able to tap that well for a long time now, and I never really have writer's block. I don't second guess myself. There is a part of me that I draw from that is a muse, and I know some artists think that's nonsense, that art is a lot of work. And it's effort. Well, it can be that, too. It is work. But I believe in the muse.
So this is actually your third book.
That's correct.
Let's talk about that. You have two others with similar themes, which is Help from Above, Push from Below, and Fight for the Middle.
Yes.
And, of course, City Boy, which we were once in here
on the show with
to interview about. So talk a little bit about those.
Well, the book Help from Below, Fight for the Middle, Help from Above, Push from Below, Fight for the Middle, is about my desire to live a middle-class life despite having a mental illness. And I was always raised... My parents were strong believers in the middle class, my dad especially, and my mother too. She was right there with them, and they both believed in a middle class, strong middle class life, and they didn't seek out great wealth. They maybe could have had it if they worked on it. My dad was successful in many ways, but he chose to be a teacher because he wanted to do the same thing. So in a sense, I'm trying to be a teacher too. And I'm trying to teach people that, for goodness sakes, in our life today in America, we're losing the middle class. Mm. You're either becoming poor or super rich, and the middle class is getting pinched off. So Help from Above, Push from Below, Fight for the Middle was really about trying to find that middle ground, not only in economically, but morally and... spiritually, you know, don't be a fanatic. Trying to find that middle ground between up and down, staying on an even keel, which is big, huge to me because my life was very unstable. Mm. When I first had the car accident, my emotions were very unstable. I was very erratic and made some bad decisions and had a hard life. But Help from Above was really the angel I had a vision of an angel, mm-hmm. and that was really the help from above. And the push from below was really the fear of not succeeding. And, you know, like the guy in the library, he was the push from below. Go out and be a writer. Don't end up like me. You know, he was a push from below. So that's that story. City Boy is really a memoir of my life. It's kind of a romanticized view of the city, and it's a stretch in some ways that I had those kind of thoughts when I was young, as if I, the way I attribute them to my character in the book. But I always thought about the city, and I always thought about how I'm going to get right, how I'm going to be comfortable in this environment, because I wasn't always comfortable, and I was acting out in some ways, and, you know, doing things that were probably contrary to my conscience. And although I did a lot in line with my conscience, enough that when I had the car accident, people really believed I would recover. My friend once told me, Rick Martin, he told me, Bruce, I have faith in you that you make it through this. And, you know, so I had friendships, and I had good things, but there were some bad things. You know, the poverty, the injustices, the unequal wealth situation, some things that were negative. But in the end, I became okay. I was happy to be alive. I mean, suicide came across once to me and as a possibility, and I just rejected that and said, no, life is worth it. Living in the city is actually a good thing, and work for the good. You know, the good may not just come to you for free. You might have to work for it, Bruce. You might have to seek it out, and you might have to make some moves in your life and ask some people some questions and put yourself out there. That's basically what City Boy was about.
I like that thought of work for the good. I think that says a lot about your character, and I think that that's something that a lot of people go through life just kind of taking, not necessarily giving back or thinking about what they're giving back. It's all about what they are going to get along the line, and I really think that that's a great thing to give back.
We start out in this world with our parents giving us everything they can, and some people never break out of that.
Mm. What kind of feedback have you received from your readers?
Well, I've received some positive. No, nobody's really disparaged it heavily. I've received a lot of positive comments, and people tell me, I'm glad you're doing better now, because I have some of the tragedies in City Boy that of my life. And people are saying, I'm glad you're doing better now. I'm glad you made it out of there. I hope it's evident in City Boy that it took a lot of work to do that. Mm-hmm. And this didn't happen. But people have kind of said they liked it, City Boy. And they said that in the end, that there was something to smile about. And that was really, because I almost lost a smile on my face at one time due to some unfortunate circumstances. And but to get the smile back on and really believe in it and make it authentic was what City Boy was all about. And I think my readers get that. And they say it's a pretty good book. One guy was just ecstatic about it. And he's a serious writer. His name is Dan Snyder. He's a writer. And he's got a big web page. He's successful. He told me, now, he was stretching this and trying to make me feel good, but he told me it was the best book he ever read. Aww. And he's read everything. He's read them all. And so he was stretching, trying to make me positive. But I had brought the book to a writing group, the head of the writing group at the U of M, mm-hmm. Michael Dennis Brown. I hate to name names, but that's the way it was. And he didn't think it was that good. And he didn't let me in to get the MFA that I wanted.
Aww.
And so I was a little disappointed. And then I showed the book to Dan Snyder, who came back with what he said. And I said, I'm going to go on as a writer. This one person, if I can make one person that happy, that's all I need, you know. And that's what a lot of people live for, just to make their partner in marriage happy. And I thought, if I can make just one reader happy, it's worth it. And if I can make many readers happy, then it's really worth it. With Hell From Above, Push From Below, Fight For The Middle, most people I've talked to have liked it. I've had less comments. I've sold less books of that. But they've liked it, told me it was an authentic story, had a lot of characters, and basically talked about a good program. They could see recovery. They could see that I was living kind of on a dream and going through a lot of emotions that were not really, and saying a lot of things that were not really in my heart. At the time, I was very distraught and very beaten down. But I would say, hey, it's a great day. The weather's great. You know, let's go out. And I tried to stay positive the best I could. And I would have my moments that was very hard to deal with and be very argumentative and hard to deal with. But basically, I always tried to keep a positive. And they have a saying in the group I'm in, fake it till you make it.
And yes,
that's exactly
I heard that.
What I did.
Excellent.
And that was Hell From Above, Push From Below. Everyone is a star. I've only had a couple people read that so far. And reviews are favorable.
Good. Excellent. We'll get more into that in a minute. We need to take just a short station break, and we'll be right back.
Programming on KFAI is supported by Metro Transit. Metro Transit now offers use of an app that connects blind and low-vision customers to a live agent for navigation assistance during transit trips. More information at metrotransit.org/AIRA.
This is Disability and Progress. We're speaking with Bruce Ariel. Bruce is the author of a book of three books now, but one, the latest is Everyone is a Star. So, Bruce, I'm wondering, do you have other books in the planning?
Yes, pardon me. Yes, I do. I have written a fourth book now. It's called Changing Ways, and it has the two characters of Bill and Sarah. Randall Smith is in there as well. Bill has become a judge after being a lawyer. And Everyone is a Star, he was a lawyer for Randall Smith, who got on the wrong side of insider trading, but in the end was found innocent, and he was innocent, and so Bill got him off on that charge, and then he became a judge in the mental health court in Manhattan. And there was some truth that the mental health court was created at the time that I said it was, and some of it's true, some of it's based on factual things, but it's really fiction. And it's about Bill and Sarah's relationship. It's up close. And Sarah's still rebellious, and she's doing some things. She has at least one bad friend, and she's doing some things that Bill doesn't approve of, and he doesn't give in to it. And she thinks she's the Virgin Mary, which he doesn't accept. It's a delusion, but he doesn't accept it. And so that's that story. It's called Changing Ways and the Changes They Go Through. Randall Smith, again, plays into the story.
So it's clear to me that your comfort zone is writing about people with disabilities and disability issues.
Correct.
Why is that so important, do you feel, to have that type of issue in the marketplace?
Well, I feel it's important because I think it's an unheard voice. And for me, it became so focal in my life having a disability. When you can't think, you're pretty disabled. Mm. And I couldn't think. And then there was a long period of time where I couldn't say what was in my heart. And I couldn't express good feelings. And being a Christian, I knew Jesus wanted me to say positive things and make a good, joyful noise. And I had a hard time doing that. And I know there's people out there that feel the same way. I mean, what do you do when you're working for a company 30 years and all of a sudden they shut you out and you're done?
Yeah.
It's hard to be joyful and make a positive. So I really am attracted to people that have had a hard time at something and really have turned it around and become positive and made it had a good influence in life and done something positive. I'm very keyed in on that. Mental health disability, it just happened. That's what my disability was. But I think all disabilities are similar in that we fight something that most people take for granted and don't even think about. I have to think about things I do. Mm-hmm. Most people just go through the motions and they don't have to consider all those things and how it plays out. But my life is such that I have to be careful what I say and, measure my words and think of things. And I want people to know about that. I think people should be curious about life. I think people should know things about who you are. That's just something I decided to do a long time. Well, that was early in life when I think I was basically honest with my friends. There were some things I wanted to keep private from them, but I think I was always honest and forthcoming. And in the end, that's what I've been. I've told all my secrets, all my stories, and I'm not hiding anything. And, I think that's really Christian, and that's what I want to be, is I want to be a good Christian.
How do you feel like the creative process has changed for you over as far as writing goes, like from your first book to now?
Okay, the first book, I was only really able to get into my own head and write about myself and understand my own motivations and create a plot line with my own life. That was my first book. Mm-hmm. Second book, I did a little more experimenting, brought in some new characters. Some of them were composites of friends of mine. Some of them were made up. Some of them were pretty much the characters that I had known them in life. And so that was the second book. By the third book, I was getting into fiction. And because I write fiction because I don't want anybody to really follow closely the path I took. It was devastating, the path I took. And in the end, I had to surrender my life over to God. And I did not live out the life that as I planned it, who I was. And so I think fiction is a good answer because now my life is fiction. It's all what I've made it. It's all what God has helped me make. And you can call it real, but it's not the reality that I experienced growing up. And so I like fiction. The process now of writing is getting into more people's heads and creating plots that has a message, yes, but there's something to be said, art for art's sake. And that's kind of what I believe in. I used to have a justification for everything. That was my father's influence. Well, is this reasonable? Does it make sense? Is it logical? And I've kind of, you could say, I like to think I've grown beyond that, but you still don't want to think of yourself as zany. but I do write fiction, and I think fiction actually reflects life more closely sometimes than what you think fact does. I think you can say things in art that no philosopher can match.
I'd like to talk about something you reference in your books. It's in reference to a place called Fairweather, and it is actually, it sounds like it's based on a place that's called Tasks Unlimited, which creates an alternative approach to mental illness hospitalization. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. That's my favorite subject. If I have one motivation right now, it is to drive Fairweather. George Fairweather was a psychologist out of the 1960s. I met him many times. A diminutive man, but with a very big spirit. And he said people with mental illness should live together and work together and support each other. It's a disability, you know, helping each other. And I've really thrived off that model. I'm not saying that it's been a rose garden or a cakewalk, but it's been good in that it's been challenging. The people I believe in, the people that I work with, I believe they're really trying. I've never met anybody that tries harder. That's the nature of the illness. You have to try pretty hard to make any progress, and it's made in inches, not miles. And Fairweather created what he called the Lodge model. And a lodge is a group home where people live and support and work with each other. And there's very little staff. Very little staff. Staff is minimal. Maybe 7 hours a week a staff is in the lodge. And it's kind of almost like a utopian idea, which attracted me. Excuse me. And it's also a radical idea to think that mentally ill people are the best people to cure each other. Of course, when you get mental illness, you go to a psychiatrist, and my psychiatrists have been helpful. My current one, Dr. Knutson, is helpful to me. But basically what he does is provide me medication, and I do the rest. And the rest is not just a given. It's, you have to work for it. You have to make choices. You have to make decisions in your life. And I've always based my decisions on what I thought was good for Tasks Unlimited. And I think I'm a good employee. Sometimes I think I'm the best employee. So you always try to do something good for the organization you're working on. You could say I am a company man.
You have talked a lot about the justice system in this latest book. How do you feel like the justice system handles mentally ill people?
Well, I think a big step forward was when they got mental health courts.
Mm.
Now, Sam, when I was hospitalized, when I was arrested, if I had gone to jail, more likely than not, I would be dead by now. Otherwise, I'd be out in the streets still homeless, committing petty crime. I would have never have had the spiritual awakening that I had from the mental health system and from Joan Unger. She gave me a belief that mental illness is not the worst thing in life. I thought it was the absolute worst, and I rejected it. Mm-hmm. I would not touch it. I would not think about it. But she helped me to realize that it's just a human frailty, and everyone's got their frailties, and yours happens to be mental illness. So I took it and ran with that. The justice system should acknowledge mental illness. It's devastating. You do not know what reality is. When I was in jail, I thought the police were gonna let the Hell's Angels in to kill me. That's really what I thought. So you can imagine how rampant my imagination went. And people with a mental illness, they're not all that way. And if you get on medication, you can make rational decisions, and that's important. The people are rational, and mentally ill people can get that. But so we deal with something that the average person does not deal with. We think things through to the infinite amount, and I think the legal system should recognize that and cut us a little slack, especially in crimes that are nonviolent and where we haven't hurt anybody. And I think the mental health system, the mental health courts that have become into prominence, they've been in about 20 years, some of them even longer now. I went through the mental health courts. I had a mental health court when I went through it, but my judge was very intuitive, and she recognized that was my better chance to be treated forgiven and to be treated with respect and dignity, and to give me help that I needed, even though I didn't realize it fully myself. She had a power and the position. She made the decision, and I think more people should have that benefit. Jail is a hard thing. Some people are commit crimes that are not mentally ill. Probably the majority are not mentally ill, but enough of them are that it should be recognized.
Bruce, I'm sure you're familiar with this, but I'd like to touch on the HIPAA policy. If you're familiar with, or anybody out there, the HIPAA presumably protects everyone. So here's a scenario here. If you're walking down the street and maybe you have a white cane or a dog, or people can see that you have a disability. If something happens or something's going wrong, people kind of know. There's really no hiding it. I always consider mental illness as the, quote, hidden disability, because you don't always know. Some people have it under very tight control, and they do very well with it. So you would not ever know. Do you feel like the HIPAA policy ever works against you if people don't know you have a disability, or do you feel like that even better protects you?
Well, familiarize me with the HIPAA policy. Isn't that the policy that says disclosures, medical disclosures? Is that something else?
It is, but it's even like you can't ask things about your disability and things like that.
Yeah, I'm glad you could say I came out as a disabled person. I'm kind of glad I did. People were not recognizing the problems I was having until I started mentioning them. And at tasks, it was kind of considered a given that you had some problems and you were going to work with them. You were going to take responsibility for them. But I was dealing with some stuff. Just my reaction time and thinking was slowed down. Some of my ideas that were coming from within me were not positive, and I had not experienced that before. I had always been kind of joyful and happy. You know, it's a hidden disease. It's an invisible disease. But I think people should disclose it and talk about it. It doesn't go away. I thought that was my hope in life, that my symptomology would go away. The only thing that's made it go away and the only thing that's made it be recovered is to own it and deal with it head on. Mm. And I don't think you deal with it head on by being secretive. And you know, I decided quite a while ago to come out and speak like I'm doing tonight, to write about it in my books. It doesn't make me less of a person to have an illness. Doesn't make me any less of a person. I have rights like everybody else. And, you know, heaven knows that everybody's got something in their life. Some things probably should not be disclosed. I believe that. But they can be disclosed to maybe one other person or a few people. But mental illness is such that your boundaries get really distorted, and I think it's just best to pretty much like the homosexuals have decided to do, is come out in the open and stop trying to hide. I think it's healthy. I don't try to impose myself on other people, but if they ask me, I'm certainly willing to tell them. I think if they come up and ask me if I'm crazy, if they come up and say, "Are you crazy?" Well, of course, that hurts, and I don't like that. But if they say, "Are you a person with mental illness?" I can say yes, and that doesn't make me feel bad.
How long does it generally take for you to write a book?
Ooh, that's a good question. City Boy, I started in 1995 and published in 2016.
Wow.
So it was a long process. That was my first book, and it underwent many, many revisions and many forms. It was first a Kindle, mm-hmm. and then a paperback, and that Hell From Above, Push From Below went a little faster. That was maybe 2 years. Everyone Is a Star had some changes to it. It used to be called Everyone Is a Hero, and I thought, Everyone Is a Hero. Well, that kind of hurt some people, because not everybody is a hero. I think everybody's a star, yes, but not everybody's a hero. Heroes are really special, and that's people that do extraordinary things. with little self-regard. And so I wanted to change the title to Everyone is a Star. That probably, excuse me, that probably took a couple years, 3 years to write, and then a little revision. My fourth book that is in line to be published eventually is taking me 3 or 4 years.
So it sounds like the more you write, the faster it gets.
That's right.
And do you feel that City Boy was your hardest one to write?
Hardest?
Yes.
Yes, because it's so honest, and I was divulging things that were private.
Yes.
And I was, in some ways, I might have even been exposing, well, definitely exposed an old girlfriend of mine, but I had felt betrayed in a relationship, so I didn't feel really bad about that. but it might have caused some of my friends to wonder what was going on. But it was hard to write for that reason, is that I was being so blatantly honest about things that most people don't talk about.
What's been your favorite book to write?
City Boy.
Ah, okay.
Yep, City Boy. They've all been good in their own way, though.
Mm. So how do you come up with the different ideas?
Well, like I said, they just come to me. I like to think that I have a muse. I had a spiritual awakening with an angel who gave me a vision of Christ. I know that sounds very holy and very untouchable, and hopefully it's not. It wasn't for me. I tried to take what I learned into my life and teach and show other people, and I learned that a lot of other people have very interesting spiritual lives too. I get the ideas from the muse, I believe, you know, the general idea, and then lately the last couple books and I think in the foreseeable future I'll be writing about justice. And justice, my ideas of about justice were really formed when I went to law school. I had 2 years of law school at one point, and then I was unable to finish. But I'm back in there now. I'm taking law classes.
Excellent.
Trying to finish up my third year. I won't get a JD, but I will get that third year. And that's really where my ideas of justice come. And once again, I found people with disabilities coming up short, being neglected, money talks, it's the rich people getting the benefits.
Yeah.
And you could call me Bernie Sanders, but I'm not a big fan of Bernie's. I think there's other politicians. I'm more middle of the road, but I think that justice escapes a lot of people. And really, one other goal that I have a lot of goals and a lot of interests. I'm very diverse. My goal is to make justice accessible to everybody. Everybody that's on their deathbed should be able to look back in their life and see how they received justice. And for a long time, that meant something like revenge to me. And my dad quickly took me aside when I was talking that way and talking about revenge. He goes, "Bury the hatchet, Bruce. Life is too short to be angry and revengeful." Christ said, "Vengeance is my territory." And so I left it at that. Whatever God decides to do about my life and other people's lives. But basically, I want to make justice accessible to anybody so they really feel that their life has been dealt with justly. Not maybe 100%, but one area of their life they can feel has really been, you've really received justice in your life. That's what really drives my writing now is justice. And the biggest people to do that are the judges and the lawyers. Lawyers receive a very bad rap from a lot of people. And I think it's unfortunate, and it's not just because I went to law school, but I do think differently as a result of going to law school. I think lawyers perform a huge benefit to society. If you can imagine people resulting to taking a club out or a gun and having revenge that way, or going to court and reasoning it out, which is the better solution? I think the courts undoubtedly are the better solution, and people can feel that, hopefully they feel that there's justice in the courts. I'm not so sure all the time, but I would like to think that I help out in that area and that I can see through the BS and know that, you know, lawyers just by nature are always trying to work for your rights. Now, they want to get paid, and some of them want to get paid well. I'm okay with that. They perform a service, and I think some people have gotten almost into the notion that they're owed justice for free. And they expect justice just to come to them. They expect to be dealt with justly without any effort on their part. And that's a pipe dream. Justice, you have to work for justice. You have to pursue it. You have to know what you're looking for, and you have to pursue it. And you have to find people that can help you if you're really interested in getting justice, or if you'd rather sit on your bar stool and, you know, and complain.
You speak a lot for the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, NAMI is an organization that helped me out. NAMI stands for National Alliance on Mental Illness, and they have helped me out. I used to do more speaking for them. I lately haven't done as much because I couldn't get the time off from work. But I spoke and told my story. Similar reasons, wanting to get my story out. I enjoy being in the spotlight. I think everybody should be in the spotlight at least once in their life. But I spoke for NAMI because I believe in their organization. I believe they do good work. They've helped a lot of people. When you get a mental illness, you don't think about it. I never thought about it growing up. That I thought I would. My mind was safe. My mind was a steel trap, and I never thought I would have the problems I had. And nobody does. But it can happen. I had a car accident, changed my life, and some people just get it. Just comes over them, and you can't stop it. It's unstoppable, and. NAMI is one organization that has really committed itself to helping that class of people, and they've done a great job, and so I'm happy to support them any way I can.
Any final things you'd like to say?
Buy my book, read it, take it to heart, enjoy it, and have a nice night.
Well, we really have enjoyed you being on the show, Bruce. Thank you so much. Take care.